sure hope this helps someone. It hurts all over again to know that there's someone out there feeling the way I felt.
I am Scott Palasek. I'm a speech therapist, faculty at the University of Akron. I've been a speech therapist for 15 years now. I'm 40 years old. The process of suicide started when I was about 8 years old, I think, and these constant negative thoughts of I was a failure at life, at being me, a failure to my family and friends, and not liking, well, actually hating how I talked. I've stuttered since I was 3 years old, and that difference in not knowing another person ate at me, and not talking about it either. I had speech therapy when I was 8 for about 6 months, and then I quit at 9 years old. Now I'm all of 9 years old, and I walk in the office and say, "Hey, I quit," and walk back out, because I was just reading things slowly over and over again, and I wasn't talking about stuttering, and I didn't, and after 10 years of, having this hatred fester, the choice of taking my own life became automatic, became unnatural. It's like ordering a pizza. It's like, I'll have pepperoni on it. Yeah, okay, it's good. It just made sense. And I wasn't questioning it. And so at 18, I was conscious of this. I want to die. And that's the best solution for me and my family. I didn't think it would matter if I was gone. And I just wanted to silence the voices of hatred towards myself and my speech, and so I would. Some people choose a gun, knife, or drugs. I use my car, and I would drive home late at night and close my eyes, play chicken with cars coming, or a tree, a house, a telephone pole. And I could feel the car going off the road. I could feel it, And I could see the headlights through my eyelids. At the last second, every time, the last second, I would open my eyes. And I don't know why, and I don't have to know why either. And that's what I've come to, is that I really don't have to know why I was a lucky. And that's what I know, is I was unfortunate. And not everyone is that lucky. At that same time, a good friend of mine noticed my disconnect from everything. Like, I had stopped talking entirely. And she saw this change and got pissed at me. And it said, "Scott, this is bullshit. And you have to talk." And I just shook my head. And she called a speech therapist right there in front of me. You know, and so I went, and I went thinking I had nothing to lose because I knew I would be dead soon. So, you know, I went almost out of spite. I thought, okay, sure, I don't care, I'll go. And I went, and the therapist sat me down and, you know, I said, "Scott, you know, talk to me." And I said, "About what?" She goes, "I don't care." And for one of the first times, someone just let me talk. And it could be about anything, and they weren't trying to change how I was talking. And that first session, if we said total, you know, like 100 words, you know, it's a lot, because I wasn't talking. And she walked me out and said, you know, "Hey, I will see you next Tuesday." And so I turned to her in shock, and I'm like, "What?" She goes, "Okay, see you next Tuesday." And I didn't have anything to say, because I just sat there for an hour and didn't talk, and yet she wants me back. And I came back for a year and a half every Tuesday. You know, she kept me in the room, you know, and I talked to her about stuttering, my family. And without those two people, I wouldn't be here. And I'm conscious of that. They saved my life in every way. I owe them the air in my lungs every time I breathe. And I had a psychologist after that, who asked the important questions about suicide that no one had asked me, that I think people had thought of or kind of knew, but I didn't ask the questions. And she allowed me to talk about it. And those people, along with many, many others who have supported me, and since then, you know, I can't pay them back. I can't. It's what they did is priceless. Before that, I owe this story to anyone who listens to it and can take something from it, anything from it. And since then, I've done things I never thought was possible. You know, I talk in front of hundreds of people, and that wasn't in my plan at 18. You know, I didn't see myself on talking at all, let alone being a speech therapist and talking in front of hundreds of people at a time. So it's very surreal every time I teach a class, or every time I play on the stage, you know, because I wasn't supposed to be here. And yet I am, and I, you know, I have to appreciate that.
I want to know about speech therapy. I feel like I know why you went into it, but tell me.
It was really, you know, interesting. I started out in business. I got my associates in it, and I started out in that major because I thought I could hide from talking. You know, I thought if I sat in a box all day and just add things, you know, I wouldn't have to talk to anybody. And then when I started getting speech therapy at 18 or 19, you know, I thought, you know, if I could save one little child from not having my darkness, then that's a career worth having. So I thought about it, I was at school one day and I saw this blind professor, and I saw all of his students kind of gathering around him and laughing, you know, with him, and you know, his, you know, his almost kind of entourage, and they cared not so much for him, and here was a guy who couldn't see them. He couldn't see physically how he was making an impact on them. I thought, you know, if he can do that, if he can get beyond not seeing and live his dream of teaching, why can't I? You know, and I owe him that. And I'm not even sure who he was or what he taught either. I saw him randomly at school, and I'll never forget him. And that's how I went in it. My first client ever in graduate school was a 5-year-old boy who had stutter. And here I thought, you know, I've been waiting all this time for him. You know, I'm going to save him. You know, he was a mirror of me. And so I had to call his mom and set up a time. And I'm stuttering like crazy at that time. And she called my supervisor and had said, he can't see my son. And it's still hard to not think about, you know, because that's what I wanted. And I cried and cried and cried. About 8 weeks later, I had her son in a kind of children's group, you know, that I was helping out with, just a random woman. And she... I came up to me afterwards. And I said, Scott, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. Because I was... When I... the work with kids, my speech would level out, I'm talking with them in a different way, and she just saw that, and she goes, I am sorry, and she asked for me in the next semester, but it just didn't happen. But I give her a lot of credit as a parent to have those open eyes to see something different. I've no idea how hard it is as a parent to have a child who's got any difference. I don't know. But she opened up her eyes. And that's a true credit to her character as a parent.
Are you specializing in stuttering, or are you doing...
I did, yeah. So in my doctorate, that was my focus in stuttering, in the social, cognitive aspects of it, and also counseling. So I do a lot of mindfulness stuff, meditation. I'll talk about values and all that stuff.
Tell me about the research you're doing now and how you've paired the stuttering with suicide. And
the research I'm doing right now is about acceptance and commitment, and that therapy. It's called action, in that sense. And we're really trying to have people live a value-based life. If you can live by those core values of being kind and honest and caring, and compassionate, those things that really make you, and that drive everything you do, then stuttering itself falls away, and it's no longer this major piece that's overwhelming you. It becomes another piece of you, but you're looking at it through the lens of I am a kind person, and I talk this way. So it's getting at that willingness to accept everything about you and all of those thoughts, like every thought that pops up, all the good, all the muddy thoughts. And that's how we're trying to fight people from going dark, I'm also the co-chair of the Akron Unsuicide on prevention, walk. We had our first walk ever this past April. It was on my my birthday, and my cousin who had died by suicide shared that same birthday too. So it was an honor to celebrate his life on doing that walk on his birthday. And our goal, you know, it's a first walk, had been hopefully 100 people coming. And maybe raise $5,000. We had 350 people come, and we raised almost $25,000. It was the fourth largest campus walk in the whole country. You know, and we're, what that told us is that there's this group of people in our area who want to be around others who share their feelings, their thoughts, loss, their challenges, and that's powerful stuff, and that's a credit to them for coming out, you know, and sharing that with us. And we had, you know, a whole family come of like 15 people, and they were all in pink, and they were there in the memory of their daughter who was died by not suicide a month earlier at 16 years old, a month, and yet they were there, you know, in full spirit and full gear, you know. Then we had a lady who had called and couldn't come because of her age. She was older, and she still wanted to give or do something. And we, you know, asked her what her connection was with this. Oh, she had lost her son and her daughter at different times. You know, which, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, how are you standing? I can't even imagine her everyday loss of her only kids who died separately by the same thing. That is powerful, and that's what we kept hearing, you know, are these stories. So allowing people a place to talk or just come and walk and think, you know, is an honor for us. So we're really excited about this year's walk. It'll be on April 26th. Yeah.
When did you decide to tell your story and become an advocate?
I told it to
a
few friends, but I first mentioned it publicly here at ASHA in 2011, and I think people were stunned, you know, because it, if you know me now, you know, I I'm very much, I love people. you know, and that was the first time that in public I had said I had had a darkness, and I thought about and killing myself, and then I said it again in a conference in California in 2012, and then here again at ASHA in 13, you know, and that's when I started to really think that, you know, this is a story that I want to now tell, you know. I hadn't sat down and thought about the entire thing before, and I thought, you know, if people take anything from it, fantastic. So that's when I first started. I'm a fiction novelist.
What?
Yeah, I just self unpublished my first book in March.
So you weren't multi-talented.
I got some talent elsewhere. and November is National Novel Writing Month, and so I've been doing this for this is my the third year doing it, and this year I'm doing my memoirs. It's called The S Card, Stuttering and Suicide, and the Stuff and People Who Saved Me. And so I've been writing that since November 1st, and I've got 180 pages of a first draft.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna finish that and maybe release it next fall,
yeah,
possibly, and get the whole story out there, because I owe that story to every person who saved me along the way. And they don't even know about it, but I do, and I need to thank them.
That's awesome. So how, you're at a conference right now, I mean, how are you getting your word count? Is 180 pages, did you get the 50,000 words, or...
I hit, oh yeah, I hit.
You won.
I won, I know. I love that too. I'm not going to lie. Like, I won.
Yeah.
And Nano. I hit 50,000 last Friday.
Yes. Way ahead of this game here.
Yeah. And that's just how I operate. Like, I love writing, you know. I've been in bands and playing and singing and on music since I was 14 years old, so you know, it is the air I breathe. You know, if I don't write or play or do something creative, I get edgy and I can feel it. You know, and that's not a good feeling. So I, you know, that's just how I live. You know, I always have that. You know, I put my creative energies in everything now. I was a chef from 14 until about 24. You know. And I cook with a love. I don't measure out things because it's not how I was taught either, you know, from the I did seafood and steak, and I did Italian food. And how they taught me was, you have to feel the food. You have to live in it. So that's how I try and be now.
So say you can't be a baker.
I dabble in.
You have to measure.
Yes. Well, that's my issue. I do a lot of cheesecakes though. So if there's a baking I enjoy, that's what it is.
Cheesecakes are tough.
They are temperamental.
They are. I taught myself cheesecakes this year.
Did you?
Yes. there's something.
They are just so iffy sometimes. But
yeah.
It tastes fine, but it can look really bad.
You can only tell if you're the one doing it, I think. Other people are like, cheesecake!
Right. They're cheesecake, it's great. I'm like, yeah, that's all right.
Yeah, I bake more than I cook now, but I have Fel cooks, and we're the same way.
Nice.
There are no measurements, it's just whatever. But I think that's how you are taught in Miami as well, I think. I don't know. What's my next question going to be? I want to talk more about creative things, but whatever. Tell me more about, I guess, the special considerations that we need to think about. Not considerations. I've been trying to formulate this question, and I don't have the right words. But tell me about what we need to be looking for in kids with speech disorders in regard to suicidality, suicidal thoughts.
Well, we're looking for behavioral changes. So if they stop socializing, if they stop talking, if they start to be more secluded, if they actually say things like, I can't talk, I just want to die. These are the signs that I think sometimes we hear and we just don't follow through as kids being serious. Now, clarifying that speech therapists are not psychologists. Counseling is still in our realm, but we need to have a plan, have contacts of people who can help these kids, or adolescents, or adults as well. And having that plan in place in case this happens is just being prepared, and that may save a person's life. Is just having a plan if it ever comes up.
Yeah. So, is it true that stuttering can't be cured?
It's true.
So, thinking about this in terms of, I have bipolar disorder, and I feel like that's the rest of my life, and then that does feel hopeless. I just wonder what that feels like. Is it the same thing, or?
And that's a great pairing, I think. Hopelessness is a really fascinating concept. And hopeless too. Hope is not a bad thing. And it's not always a good thing either. It just isn't. Hopelessness is not always bad or good either. So what we try and think about is really reality, you know, and a management, you know, these things are not going away. It's how we look at them, too. You know, it's like dyslexia, okay? You don't cure that. You have tools and strategies, and you management. You manage it. I've got a friend who's wonderful, has dyslexia, and is now a judge.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these things don't have to be, don't have to hold back people. And there doesn't have to be a cure, really.
Right.
It's just a piece of us that walks with us. We don't have to like it. Acceptance does not mean I like something. It just means I can walk alongside with it, and not judge it. You know, and that's a different process. I can walk along with stuttering now, and have other thoughts with it. I don't know if that answered
it does.
Your question.
They're just prompts. Do you still have suicidal thoughts at all?
I don't. The last one I had was probably in 2004, and it was a fleeting thing where I was on this high bridge, you know, and the thought of jumping off it, you know, had crossed my mind, and then it scared me, you know. To the point that I sat down like away from the edge of the bridge, so that I wasn't close to it. And that's where that goes now. You know, I may have these passing thoughts, and it scares me rather than me moving towards it and from it. And it's not, and I think the thoughts are just just my past coming out, you know, as a reminder of where I came from, you know, and how far I've come. And I can appreciate those cues, and not have to encourage them either at the same time.
Yeah. It's amazing once they stop being comforting.
Yes.
And they become scary.
That's interesting. I never phrased it that way before, but that's a great summary.
Yeah, I feel like sitting still, having the ability to sit still, has saved my life. You know, just being like, all right, no, I can't go do that now.
It does, doesn't it? It's such a powerful tool, and sitting still is such a powerful hard thing to do.
but yet it can change your entire
existence.
I do a lot of meditation, and the guy that I was sitting with down south was a Buddhist monk, and he was a Marine before, and so he saw everything, and he said, Scott, the hardest thing I've ever done in my life is sit and meditate. He goes, the hardest thing I've ever done. And I'm like, oh, really? Holy shit. He's seen more. And it's that seeing all of your own thoughts, is very, very frightening. Because oh my God, I'm thinking this. I'm creating this all on my own. And it's also a very empowering tool. It's like, I can sit here. I can sit with me. I can have these thoughts. And I can survive with these thoughts every day. And that's power. That's strong. And then it's all internal. And that's what's so cool about it.
Yeah. Want to know more about your support system?
It's vast now, and it's funny because I'm a introvert by nature, and then choosing to live an extrovert lifestyle. Yeah.
I understand.
Yes, you do. and that's a real interesting paradox that, I'm choosing to do. The people who support me, my mom and brother, my extended brothers, who are friends of mine, and my friends and wife, and it's I no longer have to choose to be alone, just because I don't think people care. I know they care now, and I didn't see that until the last 5 years or so, but I know that people want to hear me talk, or say things and share. And that's a powerful support right there, is mentally I know that, and they're there for me if I need anything, and the other support that I do for me is again create, that's my support to get out any pain, or any thoughts that do not line up with my values, or just that's me at the core.
What was the turning point? You said it was only 5 years ago.
My dad died in my parents were going through a divorce, and I was finishing up my doctorate, and
my caught myself yelling at my dad on the phone, and I realized how much anger I had towards him, and that opened up my eyes to how much ego had been involved in that anger, you know, because I thought that he had to be a certain father, a certain way, and that would never be, and that was unfair of me to put that on him. I'm lucky I saw it, because he died 6 months after that, you know, a massive heart attack, you know, that, and that really turned me around at looking at my own ego, you know, in the stories that I've created over years and years and years, and in the idea that there are very few facts in life, and the rest of it are things that we conjure up. They're valid, absolutely, but we create the storylines that we then cling to. And that was a major turning point at that time.
I want to ask you about, and this is something that hadn't occurred to me until I met you, essentially, or I've been thinking about it and I haven't been able to reconcile it, but there's this overarching idea that suicide is a direct result of a mental illness.
This is one of the top 10 careers.
It's funny because I don't see that as being true. I see that as trying to generalize across all people. I guess if you broke it down, you know, and said that if anyone has a negative thought or is angry, that they are mentally ill, well then yeah, that fits. Yeah, and then at that point every person is mentally ill. But I just don't see it as that simple. I think we need to reserve a judgment and a language for people, you know, who struggle, okay, who, you know, who the control of their thoughts is just not there at all, you know, and that may be mentally ill. If you cannot, you know, stop anything, if you can't control behaviors, then that's a definite challenge. So it's a great question. I don't know if there's a really good answer for it. Except we need to look at each person and not treat us as a bunch of grapes.
I've come across so many people at this point who don't even believe in mental illness. So I've tried to just remove that language from my own vocabulary, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, people definitely don't look at this. It had never even considered me. I had never considered that speech disorders would be a thing that could cause that kind of crisis until I read that article.
Mm-hmm.
Blew my mind. And we don't talk about that. You're the one. It's just crazy.
It is. It is. But, that is a great question to ask. It is. And again, there isn't a good answer for it.
It doesn't have to be. You are the answer. You're it. You're one of them. What's the future with the advocacy, your advocacy specifically?
Well, I'm going to keep doing the walk for as long as I can. I'm going to finish my book and get that out there. And keep talking to people who want to listen. I'm open about it now, and that in as painful as it is at times to think about what I could have missed, and that's what bothers me, is all of the things that I wasn't supposed to be here for, and I am. That's the rub that really eats at me, and not the actual idea of death itself, but what I've seen in the past 20 plus years that I wouldn't have ever seen before. So I'll keep honest. I'll keep trying to live by my values. And that's really all I can do.
Is suicide still an option for you, or is suicide an option for you?
It's not because I've lived that option, and it's no longer in line with the person I finally figured out who I was. I was always a kind person, honest person, a caring person, always, but I didn't know it until I started to dig in. And now I know that, and suicide by four reasons for me of anger are in conflict with all of those values. So the option of anger and a suicide, is just not in line with me anymore. So it kind of takes away that option at the end of the day.
Is there anything you think we missed that you
want to
say?
I don't know. We hit a lot of points. If there's one thing I could say to anybody who's thinking about suicide, is to tell someone. All you have to do is say the words. You can, write me, and just tell someone about it. You are not alone. There are millions of us out there who have been in that spot, that darkness. Reach out to any person, anybody, and I know it's hard. And there's love and compassion in your heart, and that's why it hurts so much.